The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the McMenamin and Wing Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic broadcast, lots to talk about, a major announcement, a legendary member of our community, the workers' compensation attorney, has officially joined McMenamin and Wing. And so I couldn't be more proud because he's one of my personal favorites and a hero of mine and so many, somebody who has actually changed the landscape of workers' compensation as we know it and impacted so many lives. And I do not exaggerate when I say that. So I'm ecstatic to announce that Jay Shure is now officially senior counsel at McMenamin and Wing. And I want to bring on Jay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. And thank you for that announcement. I'm very proud, and I'm ready to rock and roll.
Well, thank God, obviously, you know, our friends, Tom Wing and Roger McMenamin, have the good fortune, but also the foresight, and they understand the impact, not only on the firm, but also on the community. Talk about it, Tom.
Joe, you have no idea. I mean, any courtroom Jay walks into in the Commonwealth, they know him like his parents know him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very small community, and he commands a lot of respect. And so we're so excited that he's agreed to come on board with us and kind of continue this journey.
Well, Jay, you know, so I've said this many, many times when it comes to the law, okay? And I'm not a lawyer. I'm a talk show host, but I've been fortunate. So I'm an advocate for our injured workers, okay? And I've done a lot of advocacy in the union community. But in order to be a great attorney, okay, and you know, let's you know, when you talk about, you know, moving the antenna, okay, the needle, Jay has, you know, established what, a case law and all kinds of things, but also and great representation, countless, you know, great, you know, representation of clients, but also the ultimate gentleman, okay? And this business, and any business when it comes to the law, I guess there's some copyright or trademark law that doesn't take a personality, but the business of law, okay, is incredibly important. So you could be, and I think we all know this, a Harvard grad, but if you don't, and by the way, that's awesome. We all love it. But if you don't have the personality and the ability to bring the, you know, to influence and impact the clients, okay, and you know, you're not going to have success. There's nobody in the world better than Jay Shure at that. Jay, talk about that.
Joe, fate sometimes has interesting twists and turns. I brought Tom on, I brought Roger on before Tom, and now they turn around and bring me on.
Yeah.
So it's a very proud moment.
Well, it is awesome. Nobody's more excited than me because we're going to have Jay Shure on the radio show now, you know, as much as we can get him. And by the way, Jay, you had something great to say about our guest, Brian Fritz, who is calling in today. Brian's on the beach down there in Cape May. Oh, I'm sorry, Brian. I'm just kidding. you wish. Brian, welcome to the show. And you're on with Tom Wing and Jay Shure. Both great things to say about you.
Well, I appreciate that. And the feeling and the sentiment is likewise for both Tom and Jay. You know, Jay has always been an advocate. I remember, you know, hearing about Jay, you know, growing up in the area and even being a young lawyer and even aspiring to be a young lawyer, always hearing about the bulldog lawyer that he was and how he was on a quest to make sure that folks that were underrepresented received the appropriate representation to make sure that they weren't left out in the cold and the victims of insurance companies and work-related injuries. And then just the addition of Tom and them working together is just such a natural fit in our experience. And really the philosophy that's shared between all of us is really cut from the same cloth of trying to make sure that people are okay, that they get through things that that they're victims of through no fault of their own, and really trying to do the right thing. And I think that's a calling for all of us. And it's more than a calling, it's a vocation.
Well, last night when when you had called me and you had said, you know, that you, unfortunately, because of, you know, a deadline, that you could not be here, but you're definitely calling in. You would had a lot of good things to say about the firm and how, and one of the things, and we're going to talk about a lot of things, but, and Jay Shore said this on the way in, talking about the relationship between a personal injury attorney and a workers' comp. And by the way, you and I have, in fact, Tom Wing can't see this, but I have a boot on my leg. Okay, I had I was in the emergency room and I got a call from Brian Fritz a couple of weeks ago about a situation which is related to negligence to injured workers, okay, and people who are in underserved communities, okay, and Brian will actually get in a little bit to that case, but like Jay said, that, you know, it's a very important, that relationship between a personal injury attorney and a workers' compensation, you know, attorney like you and Jay are, is vitally important. And you know, so Jay, as soon as I mentioned it, and, you know, and he said Brian Fritz is going to, you know, we're going to have Brian Fritz today. I said, yep. And he started going right into the relationship. But Brian, you said last night that you are extremely fond of the firm, and you work with them by choice as part of your, you know, referral network a lot. Correct.
We do, and we have to be, and just to even add some level of additional, you know, sincerity behind that. For us, what we have to do, it's such an important relationship because the workers' comp guys are usually the first ones on the scene and they're the ones building a record. And we really have to make sure that we're aligned with people that know how to do that, know how to do that right, and really care about doing it right, because we have to live with the sins of what happens at the first entry level of things, because sometimes things are done that we just simply can't undo, because there's not a level of recognition of the importance of that, and you know, unfortunately, sometimes the client's ultimate what they have
fate
to look out for, whether that is forsaken because of the fact that certain things aren't done right from the beginning. And Tom and Jay will always make sure that the client's protected and that their third party rights and that claim is preserved.
Well, Jay just said something, and this is really interesting. Tom, I've been doing this for 9 years, about 8 years, and I've never heard anybody say this before, and it makes so much sense. Jay, didn't you mention that I've said it a lot of times. You know, it's why it's so important for somebody who gets injured on a job to go to an outstanding workers' compensation attorney. And if you're lucky enough, you're looking at the two in this studio. Jay, but there's actually a potential. If a workers' compensation attorney, okay, does not, if there's a third party case and the workers' compensation attorney does not pick up on that, there's a possible situation there, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we're not expected as workers' comp lawyers to know the details of whether there's liability or not. That's up to Brian's team.
Right.
That's why I call it a team, a partnership, because once we suspect that there's a third-party liability, we have a duty to make sure that is covered within a two-year period. If we don't, and the client eventually finds out that we should have known, we can be sued for malpractice.
And, you know, and what's interesting, first of all, you're only going to hear that from a great attorney, right? That's a fact. I've been doing this 7, 8 years, whatever, and I have not, that nobody's ever admitted that, you know, I mean, in other words, nobody's ever said that, and it means so much. It really, it's what that statement is right there, is put your money where your mouth is, but it makes so much sense. And for listeners, you know, and since I'm the non-lawyer here, I did go to community college briefly. They asked me to leave. It was wacky, but the thing is, in layman's terms, there, a lot of us get injured on the job because I was an iron worker. Okay, so I have, and when I do these shows with these brilliant people, I have the opportunity to sit down and just listen like a listener. So it does help me, you know, to not, you know, be on that level a little. But I will say this. You have, as a listener, the difference between a workers' compensation claim, which is a claim. It's not, you're not suing your attorney. I always put this, and I always give this example, and I've heard it from guys like Tom and Jay and Brian. I'm an iron worker. I'm working at a building downtown. We're in the hole. We haven't come, the building hasn't come out yet. There's a hole digging a dug, and there's no caution tape around it. If I dug that hole and I fell into it, that's workers' comp. There's no negligent party. But if another contractor, general contractor, dug that and I step in it and get hurt, that's a potential third-party case. The reason that's important is because it's the difference, only being able to get workers' compensation benefits and having a potential negligence lawsuit. So when you look at a case, Jay, okay, you're looking at it from you're checking out a lot of things, correct?
I think Brian can back us up on this. Most of the time we get a rejection because we don't know what a great case is from a third party. We can suspect it, but Brian's the lawyer that knows it. So when we submit a case for him to review and it's rejected, we have a sigh of relief. At least we did what we were expected to do. Tom has a way to look at cases better than I even, and I'd appreciate if he could talk about how he looks for a third-party case.
Sure. So at intake, we're, even before a lawyer looks at the case, the staff member who was performing that intake has a series of questions that they have to ask, and they're really designed to issue spot, to look to see if, you know, somebody else dug that hole or there's some kind of employment discrimination or there's a motor vehicle accident where there's another actor involved. And those are issues we're going to spot very, very quickly. Now, what Jay is talking about is these sort of borderline cases where it's typically a catastrophic injury and you're trying to find other insurance coverage because workers' comp is not going to make this person whole. And that's where you're going to bring somebody like Brian Fritz in to take a second look at it to see maybe there's a corporate structure where you can go after some parent company or something like that.
Somebody who's a negligent party.
Correct.
Talk about that, Brian.
Sure. Let me just jump in and say two things. One is what Jay had said a few moments ago and showing that lack of, you know, just completely not being the victim of hubris, meaning being sort of wrapped in his own, oh, I know it all type mentality. And that's really, a lot of times dealing with professionals, you become the victim of that. And he's been so successful and divorcing himself from that level of ego, you know, knowing and realizing, hey, we don't know it all, but let's make sure our clients get the people that might be able to complement what we do. And that's so critically important. And let me jump into your question. Let me use a medical analogy right off the bat. There's something called a differential diagnosis in medicine, where a doctor has to look at something and they can't just go in with their knee-jerk reaction saying, well, I'm the medical expert genius and I think it's this, so therefore it is. They have to go through a list of what else can it be. That's a differential diagnosis. What else can it be? And then get in the right consults and everything else to make sure that those things are explored for the well-being of the patient. And this really is very similar to that, where the workers' comp attorney gets it and says, okay, well, there might be something here, but I really don't know. Let me get it to somebody else. And we've had situations where, let me use a real-world example. A gentleman was backed into while he was delivering pretzels by a guy who was delivering ice in a truck. Now, that's okay, that seems like a slam dunk. Okay, you go against the trucking, the guy, the operator of the truck. You know, not only is workers' comp, maybe we settle the auto claim too, and some attorneys might try to keep that all in-house. Well, the workers' comp attorneys that sent that to us felt that there was something more there, and they were right. Now, if they would have kept it in-house, they would have learned that the operator of that truck that caused the accident only had a $35,000 policy. What we did was we stuck someone in surveillance and followed that guy to see where he went to get the ice. And we saw him going at 4 o'clock in the morning to an ice facility, opening up the place, you know, almost as if he owned it. And we're able to argue some level of that he was acting as a quasi employee or agent of the place. But more importantly, what we're also able to show was underneath FDA regulations, okay, the maker of that ice has a duty and responsibility to control all aspects of the transportation from the time it leaves its facility to the time it actually hits the ultimate vendor who's going to give it to the customer. And because of that, we were able to then expand upon the available level of responsibility and resources that were associated with that and actually get that guy the recovery that he deserved. Now, had that been held by a workers' comp firm that just said, okay, well, we'll just take the quick hit on the auto policy and the workers' comp, that guy would have been left out in the wind.
Well, let's talk about the difference there. Well, Jay, workers' compensation, in a sense, is wage replacement, right? And so, in other words, when somebody, when you get a, and there are settlements, you know, also associated with it, with you and, you know, and you're in the past have actually created that the ability to do that. But my question to you is, what a normal workers' compensation case, if there was no third party element, you know, what does somebody get when they get workers' compensation? And then we'll go, okay, what the third party element, and you know, you get that plus the pain and suffering and a bunch of other things. But what does somebody get when it's a workers' comp case? Well,
workers' comp is limited to your wages and payment of your medical bills. One of the biggest factors in a third party case is pain and suffering. Pain and suffering. Someone gets injured, they want to recover for pain and suffering. You can't do it on our side. It has to be a third-party case. And if there is no third-party case, then it's up in smoke. It's not going to happen. Right, Tom?
No, absolutely. And unfortunately, we have to give that sad advice routinely when someone is catastrophically injured and there isn't a defective piece of machinery or some third-party.
But the interesting part about that, Tom, is I have seen people who have, you know, have gotten injured on jobs and they swore they had a third party case. The truth is, and after they found out what the truth is, even though it could be, you know, they may have a work comp a case and they don't have a third party case. Yeah, it's not the best news, but they're grateful that they had a great attorney to sit there and actually analyze it, because the truth and being honest with your client. This one guy, it was an iron worker. I got a call. You know, he had an elbow surgery and it went bad. He swore the doctor was a heavyweight doctor at one of the big institutions who was supposed to do it, didn't do it, didn't do the surgery. He left something in there. All this, okay? All this. And finally, you know, he got work comp, but he did not. He couldn't get anybody to testify. He couldn't get a personal injury attorney. Finally, a med mal attorney said, look, he broke it down for the guy and said, you might have a case, but it's a small one. And he explained why that it's minor. That guy was so appreciative that his actual, like the truth, when you talk to your clients and you give it to them the way you're supposed to give it to them and you don't beat around the bush after you guys have done, everybody on this call does your due diligence, can set someone free. It's not a third party, verdict, but it's something that is, you know, may impact the injury victim, you know, tremendously in a positive way.
Sure. I mean, we have to understand is these people have been injured and wronged and they want justice. And the measure of justice that our system can provide sometimes is very good and sometimes is not. And when you're handling a claim for someone who's in that situation, you should treat it like you're representing your brother or your sister or your cousin, and you want to leave no stone left unturned, right? You want to make sure you're looking at every angle. And so if it turns out there isn't a recovery, well, at least you actually did the work to find out what was available for them.
Absolutely. But Brian, let's kind of segue a little bit, okay, into this world of, you have had. This is your specialty. So you do you've been working on construction, third party construction cases, amongst other areas. Okay, but this is a big area for you. You've done a lot. Coming from the labor community, I've done a lot of shows on undocumented workers, individuals that are not in a union, okay? Not everybody can get in a union, okay? So you can't sit there and walk around. Okay, I do the labor show. I've been doing, my dad was a labor leader for 40 years. I remember my dad saying to me one time, I got nothing against anybody who's, an employee who's not in a union. They all can't get in unions. They got to work somewhere, right? His issue was with employers that take advantage of the workers. But my point to you is this. A lot of these people, especially individuals who come from you know, if they're undocumented, or, you know, if, you know, they're not in a union and they're working for a predatory contractor, they can get taken advantage of on the job, and they have no rights. Now, there's employer situations there. Like, Tom, you just said a little while ago, we'll check to see if they have an employee because if they've been fired. But Bri, talk about, you know, you have some things going on now where somebody who, you know, who was, you know, under from an underserved community, somebody who was being taken advantage of, and they paid for it dearly. It crosses, it's a work situation. So, of course, we want Tom and Jay's input. But if you would start that conversation.
Sure. I think where we're going with that is, you know, and what we have to realize is that danger doesn't discriminate. Okay? People may, but danger doesn't. And in the context of that, we were talking about it yesterday, Joe, was this. You know, there's a lot of statistics out there with regard to certain minority groups, predominantly Hispanic and African American, occupying a lot of the more hazardous industries. And that's sort of a direct correlation to the longstanding disparities with regard to socioeconomic standing. And here's the situation. When you start getting into the manufacturing, construction, whatever, you know, and you have these folks occupying what's called labor stratification in the lower levels and the most hazardous of jobs, right? The ongoing racism that has plagued society really has to be investigated to make a determination if, in fact, that is echoing or somehow being manifested towards those folks in those highly dangerous areas. Because what they're finding is that the incident and death rates with regard to those populations within the high hazardous industries are disproportionate to other groups. Now, what's the reality of that is? Well, those types of jobs aren't just inhabited by folks minority status. There are all sorts of folks in there. There's human beings of all that look and sound all different, as well as all genders within those areas of work. So if you're not being safe, or you feel that certain groups are disposable, and you have that pejorative type viewpoint on certain groups, well, chances are you're going to apply that to everybody that's inhabiting that level of your company or that occupation within a trade or on a job site. And, you know, when you have that danger and that's allowed to fester and exist, it's one, indicative of a lack of a safety culture, and then two, basically not following with true adherence to OSHA, because OSHA does guarantee their equal protection for those OSHA compliance with OSHA standards, no matter what race, creed, color, religion, etc. And if employers aren't following that, and it's termed or deemed to be some level of discriminatory practices, well, then that has to be exposed. And that's one thing that we're actively adding to looking at in our cases, especially the ones where we do have folks that are undocumented or they hold some level of minority status, is what is the managerial philosophy that's in place that's impacting their safety, because it's not just their safety, it's everybody within that stratification of labor and potentially everybody else on a job site.
And so let me jump in there for a second, because of course, you know, I'm a union guy, but this is not about union. And by the way, there's plenty of non-union companies that do it right. So it's, in other words, treat their employers fine and all that. The unions weren't created for them companies, okay? The people that do everything the right way, pay their employees properly, and also make safety a priority and all those things. Unions were created for those who take advantage of people. And let me just say this. In Pennsylvania, it's an at-will state. So imagine if you don't. Unions have representation. You have a job steward and all that. So if there's an issue you can see, you can call the steward right there. He's on the job and say, listen, we got a hole right there, or we got a scaffolding that's where there's an issue. And they'll remedy that. Or you'll get the union representative coming from the union hall and they'll deal with it. And you have a collective bargaining agreement, so you're not getting fired for pointing out that. But if you are unrepresented, I don't mean undocumented, I'm talking about unrepresented, we live in an at-will state, you could lose your job, okay? And you could lose your job for any reason. And so some people who are vulnerable, get in those situations, and they have families, and they have no choice but to work, okay? And there's sometimes catastrophic, you know, injuries, death, all those things. I want to bring Jay into this because you guys are on the front line, Tom and Jay. You guys are, you know, where the work injuries are. And I'm talk about some of them vulnerable populations who, you know, you come in and all of a sudden, you know, you see that they've gotten injured, but also, you know, in conditions that were less than stellar. Tom?
Sure. So, I mean, I'm thinking of a number of construction cases I've handled relatively recently. As you know, Philadelphia has been kind of in a construction boom for a number of years now. And we are seeing a lot of very catastrophic injuries suffered by undocumented immigrants that were completely preventable. That if they had had OSHA standards in place, if it had been a reputable employer, it just wouldn't have happened. People falling from exceedingly high heights.
Oh, yeah.
People getting run over by equipment, really just really awful injuries that if these employers were following the rules, this would have never happened. There is no safety culture.
Well, it's interesting. And Bri, you know, we go way back and we all go on this call, go way back. I did a labor show one time. I'll never forget this show as long as I live, where these workers on Broad Street were working for a company. They were not happening not to be in a union. They were working on the weekends, and they were going up on an elevator and bringing, you know, like one of those, material hoists. And they were on top of it and going up, not in it, but on top of it. One of them called his wife and said, listen, if something happens to us, I just want you to know what happened. They actually came to us and wanted to talk about it on the radio, okay? And that, you know, and they were working at nights on the weekends, so no one could see them, right? So did L and I. So there are OSHA standards like you're talking about, okay? And there are city standards, construction standards, and you have, like, I remember when I was an iron worker in 1982, which seemed like 15 minutes ago, you didn't have to tie off walking on a beam, okay? Now they have static lines and all those things. But the point I'm making is that a lot of individuals are working in conditions where if they complain, they could get fired.
Oh, yeah. Certainly, of the workers that I was just talking about, they're routinely threatened in the hospital. Their boss will take them to the hospital and then tell them if they report this to anyone, they're fired or they'll be deported or something like that. We see that all the time.
Bri, talk about that. Especially when it comes to third party, if the company is not abiding by the OSHA standards, okay, or if the L&I standards are, you know, whatever, is that, grounds for, you know, so they're supposed to have workers' compensation, okay? And I'm going to ask the gentleman here what happens if the company doesn't have it in a minute, but well, if they're not following OSHA standards, is that a grounds for third party negligence?
So it depends on who's not following, okay? If we're dealing with a construction site, the GC has overall safety responsibilities, typically through contract or through just industry practices and standards and or being the signatory to the permit with the local municipality. They'll have overall safety responsibility, which then has to trickle down, and they have safety oversight of their subcontractors. Typically, the injured worker works for one of the lower-tiered subcontractors on a project, laborers, carpenters, et cetera, on that project. And that's where we see most of the immigrant workers, the undocumented workers being, such as Brazilian framers. Or there's also this influx of Brazilian iron workers where these companies that are run by Brazilian individuals are also accompanying them to the hospital, like Tom, like you were just alluding to with Tom, and they're being told, or they're doing the translation for them. So suddenly someone falls three stories and then the medical record says, well, they fell off their bike.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that, right? Something ridiculous. And then we have to combat that. But ultimately, for pointing what you're saying is the GC would ultimately be responsible. In terms from a perspective, from a third-party perspective for the employer themselves, it depends whether or not they are the W-2 employer and how they're being paid, et cetera, et cetera. But if all those things are traditional as what we expect, then Pennsylvania has very generous immunity from third-party suits via the Workers' Comp Act. However, it should be noted that our sister state, New Jersey, realized the courts in a case called Laidlaw in the early 2000s determined that, whoa. They said, and this is a situation where you had an employer committing repeat OSHA violations for the same thing. Now, it's not limited to just OSHA violations. It's when they create what's called a substantial certainty of harm. And what the court said in that case was, there's no way the legislature ever intended to give anybody an out or a pass or immunity when they continue to do the same actions knowing that they're placing someone at risk. So we're removing that cloak of immunity, and we're going to let you get sued so that maybe, you know, I'm sure the implied sentiment is that maybe if you have the threat of a lawsuit, you'll actually start complying with OSHA. So, but Pennsylvania has not yet adopted that type of provision.
Incredible.
Ryan, you reminded me of something. As you know, in workers' comp, OSHA requirements don't matter. You need an injury on the job, and we're good.
Yeah.
However, the relationship between the third-party attorney and the workers' comp lawyer has a further aspect to it, and that is that our client is going to testify in the workers' comp case, and his testimony can be very damaging to his third-party case if an unsuspecting workers' compensation lawyer isn't attuned to that. Very important.
Oh, especially if the defense attorney is looped in with third-party defense counsel and they start going a little too far abroad on cross-examination.
And let's expand upon that for a second, Joe, because both what Jay and Tom are critical, important things about the interrelationship between what they do and what folks like myself do in terms of third-party. Certain times, there may actually be situations where the person, the company being put down on the workers' comp stuff with first notice of compensation payable, et cetera, may not be the actual employer. And there may be confusion as to who the hell the actual employer is. And, the, you know, by putting things down on those types of that type of paperwork, and if people are just blindly signing off on that, it may be substituting in a third-party actual defendant that's not corrected. And then all of a sudden you have a lot of other problems later on because you're going to get arguments of immunity with that. So in our situations, a lot of times, and I'll give you for example, is we had a case that was rejected where it was a dock builder. He was hurt on a site, and everybody said, okay, well, the employer controls safety, and the employer controls safety. And it was a significant injury, so we did some of our homework. And we found through other ways that, yeah, it might look like the employer, but the actual guys running safety are employed by a different company within the corporate family. And we then worked with the compensation attorney to make sure that that company wasn't slipped in somehow, either in through releases or other documentation that some that the client may unwittingly release them from third-party liability. And we were able to preserve that and hold them in, and that resulted in a $7 million settlement for that gentleman.
General releases are really important. So what Brian is talking about are at the end of a workers' comp case, a lot of times, not only are they settling the workers' comp claim, they're settling any and all other claims that can be released against that particular employer or sometimes any affiliated entity. And those releases, if you're not careful, can be exceptionally broad.
Let me ask you a question then. This may run into why people shouldn't be dabbling in workers' compensation. I've talked to some personal injury attorneys. One in particular, I'll never forget his words. He said, I tried dabbling in workers' compensation, and he's a really good medical malpractice guy. And he said, I got out of it so quickly I couldn't even, you know, shake a stick. He said, because it's, you know, it everything changes so quickly, and I knew better. But that has to be why what you're talking about there, Tom, you need to have top-notch representation, because I'm going to take a shot at this. This is a really interesting conversation. I'm assuming the insurance company tries to get that general release from the workers' compensation attorney before the third-party case is even on the table.
They do. And they'll send it to you 24 hours before an approval hearing. They really try to skirt these in as quietly and quickly
as they
can.
How do you respond? And by the way, how do you guys, as top work comp attorneys, what's your answer to that one?
Nice Jay, try. You recently handled this in a claim.
You just have to turn it down. I mean, you can't cripple Brian and his case.
Right.
And there's many ways that can happen. We talked about our client's testimony. Let's take a punch press case and causes a dramatic injury, an amputation.
Oh, boy.
And the client comes on and says, yeah, we know that punch press is 80 years old and my employer screwed around with it. Well, Brian, you could talk to this, but that case has just been ruined. On the other hand, if the company had another company that came in to take care of that punch press every year and keep it going and look at the parts and make sure it runs, and then it goes malfunction, then a guy like Brian can come up with a basis upon which to pursue the third-party claim.
Talk about that, Brian.
Sure. And what you're getting at is that more or less that there's something separate in parts or someone outside the employer-employee relationship that came in and stuck their nose in. And when they did that under the law, they would have to do so and make sure that it was done in a non-negligent fashion, meaning that they had to take a foreseeable approach to say, how can what I'm doing potentially hurt someone, and what am I doing to either guard against it, test against it, warn against it, design against it, and or train against it, right? And most people don't do that. They're happy to get to work. They go in and they throw something together as a modification to please the owning plant entity, and they just put it in place without a lot of regard. And, you know, people wind up getting hurt. But that has to be flushed out, and that's not always evident just by looking at a machine. And let me add to that, Jay, is this. Sometimes in a corporate family, there might be other companies upstream that actually hold the purse strings, and they authorize modification of machinery and also underneath certain provisions of the tax code, if they're filing consolidated returns, they can be considered owners of that machinery if they're depreciating it or depreciating the modifications. And also by authorizing those things and paying for it under certain applicable standards known as ANSI standards, they may step into the shoes of actually the manufacturer by modifying the machine. So that's even more critically important to determine who actually authorized those modifications, not just who did them.
Wow. Okay. So, please say.
There's one other aspect of the relationship between third-party attorney and workers' comp attorney that I'm going to ask Tom to talk about.
Please.
And that's called subrogation.
Oh, yeah. So when subrogation refers to when a workers' comp insurer pays out benefits because workers' comp is no fault, and then somebody like Brian goes out and recovers money from an at-fault party.
Right.
The workers' comp gets to subrogate against that recovery. They get their money back.
Because the individual got injured because of some other third party, correct?
Right, exactly. And so the law treats it as in the third party claim, workers' comp has an injury too because they had to pay money through no fault of their own. In fact, it was through the fault of this other party. So they get to step into the shoes of the injured worker and recover what they've paid.
This, I just want you to know, this is such an awesome conversation. I feel like I'm sitting there just watching three maestros go back. I'm not kidding you. This is potentially the best third-party conversation I've ever been apprised to. Bright, let's talk about the communications necessary, okay, and the importance of, you know, and the reason I said that is because I'm listening to the three of us, and I'm seeing these guys here in the studio say, they're nodding their head because they get what you're saying. And I typically get a lot of stuff, but I'm listening to stuff, but I'm like, I mean, I got to, somebody get me a pen and paper. I got to take some notes. But my point is you're working together in concert, okay? Talk about the importance, especially since, Tom, you just mentioned that there's like a form, a general, reminds me of Kramer on Seinfeld when he settled for all the coffee, right? You know, like, in other words, people who have tried to do these things on their own, or an inexperienced attorney or whatever, somebody who's not looking at the big picture. Oh, you're injured in work. It's not a third party case. They're not really a work comp attorney, or they are, and they don't look at the whole process, could literally cost that employee millions of dollars. And somebody might, some attorney who's not experienced or lazy might sign that release at the end there and literally change that individual's life, you know, for as long as they live.
Oh, no question. I mean, there's probably half a dozen times where you have to be on the phone with the third party lawyer, making sure that the two cases are going to line up properly. So releases is a great example. Anytime you're going to settle or compromise part of a claim, that's going to impact subrogation. So you can address that in settlement negotiations. Workers' comp can waive or give up part of its lien. Those are all conversations that have to be had with all the lawyers involved in the claim, not just the workers' comp.
Well, let's talk about that communication part between the three of us. Okay. I mean, you guys are with the same firm. Jay and Tom are with the same firm, but I know you guys have worked together. So you guys are working the work comp side of things. And obviously there's a lot of complications, and people, as I'm learning as I see this right now, you get a lot of, there's so many intangibles about being a lawyer, okay? One of those is communications. Now, you guys didn't get what you just got by not being top communicators with the clients. But I see right now that it's that professional courtesy with the client and calling them and having that line of communication, that extends with between the third party and the workers' compensation relationship as well. I mean, you know, it sounds like in order for you to work in concert, not only do you have to be knowledgeable of what's going on, but you got to be communicating. Talk about how important that is, Jay.
You know, I mean to ask a question of Brian Fritz that's on my mind.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, we have doctors that we send our clients to for injuries, orthopedic doctors, neurologists on occasion. And I'm wondering, the other side, of course, always says your client is totally recovered and he could do any job in the world. Brian, are those reports used in third-party cases, or are a new set of doctors used at the time of a third-party prosecution?
So, and Jay, it's a great question. It depends on the magnitude of the case, and it depends on what we're doing, and it depends on what that doctor may have been asked to really look at with regard to what was before him at that time. Usually we see a whole new set of reports and doctors from the defense side. For us, there might be, rather than reinvent the wheel, if there's enough there and it covers the same issues and everything that typically comes up in a third-party realm, then it might make sense to just keep the same doctor aboard, especially if that doctor's not only serving as an expert but also as a treater.
And because workers' comp, you guys often get these situations when they're related to a work case. Talk about that. Let's delve into that medical side of things and how important the credibility of the, because so many people, you get injured. I've been going to my family doctor, right? So for 30 years, but all of a sudden I get injured. And all of a sudden I'm not getting that same fuzzy feeling when I go in the house, when I go in there. So it's not easy for somebody who tries to navigate something on their own. Once they realize, let's say they go to the panel doctor and that panel doctor's looking at them and saying, looking at them. I've had a lot of our construction guys in our union industry sit there and go, they've walked into the office. They didn't even get, even get looked at yet. And the doctor says, I'm sending you back to work just so you know that. I mean, this is a rude awakening to a regular human being who's never been through this, or even if you've been through it before. Talk about the importance of having a credible, quality medical network, okay, with specialists, the whole deal, to help injured workers and injury victims. Tom?
So I'll touch on the company doctor first. So company doctors are work for the insurance company. They're not looking out for the injured worker. They want more business from that insurance company. They want to stay on that designated list so that they get all the treatment in that first 90 days of every single claim that that insurer has. Their interest is not to make the injured worker better. Their interest is to keep that insurance company happy. So the difference is we have a network of doctors and they're all over the place, right? We have doctors, we have relationships with it, University of Pennsylvania, Jefferson, all over the place. And these are doctors that you would go to on your regular insurance. But we can say, hey, look, this person will see you even though you have workers' comp, because as you talked about, a lot of times your regular sort of neighborhood family doctor is not going to want to deal with billing workers' compensation and then waiting for a denial or hoping to get paid. They don't know that system.
Well, let's talk about the credibility. And Brian, in your world, and this is a really interesting point, okay? Talk about the credibility of the medical provider, because in workers' comp, and I'm sure in personal injury, you mentioned that, and we talked about the family doctor not being willing to treat because they don't want to get into the billing or anything like that. However, when you do have an individual, a top professional, a medical professional who is willing to treat injured workers and injury victims, their credibility as experts is important because they don't only have to lay their butt on the line for this injured worker, it may be a claim petition or whatever, and wait to get paid, but they may have to go testify. And their credibility is really important, right? This, a lot of times you go to these panel locations and you're not even seeing a physician. Talk about the importance of a doctor who's an advocate for patients' rights and injured victims' rights and their credibility and the need for them to stand behind their treatment and their diagnosis.
Well, I think Brian's problem and ours is different.
Okay.
Our main concern is to get our clients.
The answer normally is you're right, Joe. I like you. I'm just kidding.
Our biggest concern is to make sure our client gets treated. Most don't have insurance. They don't know where to go. We send them to a doctor that will treat them and wait for the award to be paid. And if the award never comes, they eat it. Brian's whole show is much different. He's not looking for a client to be treated. He's looking for an opinion, a powerful opinion, to present to a jury about the loss of earnings, the pain and suffering of the injury, completely different.
Well, Brian, talk about that, because there's one thing that people in your world don't realize, and this is vitally important when they're looking for a third party, for a personal injury firm. And when we talk about the working together, the referral network, and the importance of it, one thing that I know Tom Wing and Jay Shore know is that their referral partners are going to have the resources to be able to, represent that client. What does that mean? Well, I'm just talking to my fellow lay people out there, and that is, Brian Fritz from Fritz and B and Cooley, can they afford the experts? Can they do all those things? Things that people like me would never even know. But a lot of times those experts are medical, doctors. Talk about how that weighs in on your case, and along with what Jay just said.
Sure. So let me handle that in a couple different ways. First and foremost, let me dovetail into what Jay had said, is that there is a difference between the level of proof of what the cases require on our end and as well as his. But there is they intertwine on this common denominator, is the fact that the credibility, and it's important that the workers' comp folks have the horses to make sure that the credible that the claims that are being pursued that will overlap into ours are being presented with the most credible expert testimony in order for those claims to survive. Because here's what happens, and this may not make a lot of sense. In the event that there's a ruling finding that the claim does not exist or is not work-related, that serves to be a preclusion, that will preclude us, in our case, from continuing to pursue that claim. All right, so it is important that those claims are presented with the best available experts as possible. Then when we get the case, There might be some additional things that we have to have done, like Jay said, so that those expert opinions go into the damages that are available in our case that's not important or available in the workers' comp case. That goes into the future life care planning, the future wage loss, the future limitation of occupations, and we have to have the expert doctors that have the foresight to be able to talk about that parade of horribles that the person might experience. I've had one where there was a coordination of experts between a neurologist determining that someone had what's called complex regional pain syndrome, CRPS, or it would used to be reflex sympathetic dystrophy. And we took that from a pain management standpoint and made a determination that there'd be increased blood flow to an area, and then which we took that to the orthopedic expert that determined that in the event that were to occur because of the person's age, the bones would become more brittle, and that if they would have an additional fall, they may not be able to withstand surgery and may have to have the leg amputated. So it went from, you know, an orthopedic injury that would have been available in the workers' comp case. We took that and we had a bunch of different experts look at it to make sure that the future was fully expounded upon with regard to what the damage claims could be in our cases.
Ryan, don't forget loss of consortium, which I'll let you explain.
Sure, I'll get to that in a second. But then to go into what you're saying, Joe, is that putting all that stuff together does take the resources necessary to do it. And in order for those cases to make sure that they have the ultimate value, and that's why we'll work with people like Tom and Jay, because they know that we have the resources to do it, and we also have the resources of them to help make sure that they give us a good groundwork to help save the client money initially. And what Jay brought up as a loss of consortium claim is the spouse, in our case, has a right to losses. The non-injured spouse, the way I always explain it is that the law views a married couple as a sports team. So if you don't have the goalie in net, the rest of the team has to play harder to win. And that's sort of how the law views a married couple in the simplest of sense. And you lose all the things you used to enjoy doing, the things that used to make you a happy couple, a special couple, a unique couple. If those things have been diminished and the intimacy level is also wrapped into that, then the non-injured spouse does have a claim for that. And that's something that has to be recognized. And sometimes they're very significant, especially where you have the injured spouse. Let's say that they suddenly become that they're a paraplegic, or that they have an amputation and they can't necessarily clean themselves after going to the bathroom or shower or anything else. Well, now the non-injured spouse has to jump in and start doing all those things. So when you take that vow, for better or worse, sometimes you really don't realize how worse things can be.
Right.
And the loss of consortium claim recognizes that.
Wow. I mean, that is as real as it gets. I mean, that is intense. And that's why when I look around and, you know, the table and listen to Brian, people don't realize, there's a saying, everybody wants to be the boss, but they don't really want to be the boss. Like, you know, what you guys do and dealing, you know, and meeting people every day that have gone through injuries like that and a spouse that has either lost somebody or dealing with the results of catastrophic injuries is just unprecedented. We only have about 2 minutes left, and I want to get into real quick the contingency fee agreement. Neither one is, when somebody comes to see, you know, the individuals on this call, they may be thinking, how much is this all going to cost me out of my pocket? Brian, if you would, and we're going to do this in a 30-second, you know, if you could each sure. Talk about that real quick.
Sure. No, a client never goes into their pocket to pay us a dime. The courts keep the courts open for the working person, the person that doesn't have the ability to have oil wells in their backyard and stuff like that, and they have to work for a living, can't afford to pay an attorney by the hour. So what we do is we collect the fee at the end of the case, and we get our costs back then, and nothing ever comes out of the client's pocket, even if we have a negative result. That's our cost of doing business, and it's just our pleasure to be able to try to achieve a victory for the client, and we're happy with that, and we're happy to get paid at the end.
Jay Short, contingency fee agreement?
Workers' compensation and attorney fees are limited by law to 20%.
Doesn't come out of their pocket, up front?
No, 20% only if you win. If you lose the case or it turns out not to be a case, then we have to just eat that.
Okay, let's do this real quick. Brian Fritz, contact information for our listeners, please.
Sure, Brian Fritz, Fritz and Bean Cooley, 215-458-2222, www.fbesq.com.
Tom Wing, contact information at the firm.
Sure, you should just follow me on TikTok, at THWESQ.
And of course, I want to finish off by, first of all, Brian Fritz, thanks so much for joining us. Fantastic segment. And of course, our host, Tom Wing, always fantastic. Shout out to Tyler in our producer's room. But again, I want to, follow up on this major announcement. Obviously, we want to welcome Jay Elliott Shore, who is now senior counsel at McMenamin and Wing. The stature, which was already incredibly high, just went through the roof. Welcome, and it's going to be great to have you on the broadcast, Jay.
Thank you. And Brian, say hello to my girlfriend, Megan.
I will. And listen, so I couldn't join you guys in person. Thanks for accommodating me, Joe, by allowing me to do it by phone.
Awesome. Listen, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the McMenamin and Wing show here on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank Brian Fritz, of course, Jay Shore, and our host, Tom Wing. And shout out to Roger McMenamin, who's playing hooky again. Tom Wing's the TikToks are going through the roof. Great stuff. On behalf of everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.